The following program was pre-recorded for presentation at this time. The comments are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Sonics Incorporated or CKRZ-FM.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us here at CKRZ. I'm Al Sue, and today we have what will be for some of us an educational program. I know it will be for me. It's all about restorative justice, and we have a very learned panel with us today to tell us more about that particular topic. And joining us today, we have Barbara General. Barbara is a justice director with the program that they have here at Six Nations. Tom Porter will be joining us today as well. We have Lady Canal, Lee Hill, and Abby Avery. And as well, we'd like to welcome Lance Logan Key into the house. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, our topics of discussion today include: what is restorative justice? Where did restorative justice originate from and its history? What does restorative justice look like at Six Nations? And our wrap-up will be all around how it will look in the future here at Six Nations and where we are heading. And probably I think a good person to start this program off would be Barb, who's very knowledgeable as well in this field. And she's helped me a great deal to learn some of the aspects of the subject matter itself. Good morning, Barb.
Good morning, Al. And Scanos Luego to everyone out in CKRZ land. And so I'm going to be conducting the interview with the panel. And I just want to give some credit to Abby Avery. She came on at the last minute. We pulled her in because one of the participants canceled. So Abby Avery was assistant crown for Brantford Court for 15 years. And we have Lance Logan Key, who is the extrajudicial measures worker and works for corrections, and he's an expert in helping youth. We also have Lee Hill, who's an expert in helping youth as well. She's new to restorative justice and doing very well. And then we have Lady Cannell, who's been doing restorative justice with us for about a year and a half. And I can't wait to hear Tom Porter when he gets here, because he's also has done worked in the prisons for, I think he said, about 14, 15 years. Wow. So he would be an expert in telling you what our people need in regards to a rehabilitation and, valuing them, even though they have committed some crimes. So we want to look at restorative justice here. I'm going to start with the first question they have is for everyone, is to give their input in regards to what is restorative justice from an Indigenous perspective. So whoever wants to start. Ladies.
Okay. So we know that restorative justice comes from Indigenous practices. So restorative justice has been used by the criminal justice system as an alternative to incarceration. So we try to bring people together to resolve the incident and not harm in a way that is meaningful to all of them. So what I have learned in the community is how this was done in the past when people had been dealing with conflict, the clan mothers bring them together to talk about it, to try to resolve it in a way that is going to avoid further harm. So that's what we're trying to do in the community.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? So basically, when I thought about restorative justice, when I was asked by counsel to see why there were so many people in criminal court foyers, I had to find the programs, what would be appropriate to them. But based on Ganyashagola, the great law, so that's what I use to formulate all of these programs, all the programs, values and principles, how we conduct ourselves, and really looking at the story of Tadadaho and how the community, the peacemaker, you know, Hiawatha, helped him recover from being an evil person into a good person. So with that came, you know, the philosophy, everybody has the ability to transform, which is the philosophy of the Justice Department and programs, mm-hmm. is that everybody we that comes in that we see through our lens is that, yeah, they committed some acts, but we also know that they have the ability to transform based on our teachings, right? So that's how we are operating at the Justice Department. I think Tom is here too now. So does anybody else want to contribute to what is it? What is restorative justice from an Indigenous lens?
With corrections, working with the Extrajudicial Measures Program, I guess that's my personal way of introducing it into the program, is my background. For the last part of my career, say for the last 15 years, that's what I've been doing, is I've been taking traditional teachings and forming the programs around it, so that when it comes to restorative justice, that's the same lens that I use in the EJM program, mm-hmm. is to take all those transformative properties that come in the great law, the creation of the great law. So when I'm working with youth, that's how I'll present it. I'll talk about the cannibal, Jagosa say, and all the things that they had to go through, the trials and tribulations that the peacemaker had to go through, and what he had to demonstrate to people. So it's not me as a worker telling them, I have to demonstrate to them. So I try to make it as living as possible for every client that comes through so that they understand. For the most part, I don't see them as what I've been told from a lot of the approaches I've heard from different people, usually not necessarily in the justice system, is they'll look at youth as bad kids. Mm-hmm. I've never had a bad kid. I've had a kid who's been in a bad situation and had to make some choices. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they're making choices from places that they don't have a lot of good choices to look at, even if they were aware of them. And that's, a lot of it is reflective in that, the story of the great law and how it came to how it was created. So I try to draw a lot of parallels to their lives and a lot of things that happened in there so that they understand they're living a life in a place that they didn't have a lot of good choices to start with. And I try to open up more doors for them, that there's a different path, but they have to choose it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different things I incorporate in that as well.
Yeah, I think from a Haudenosaunee perspective, I got to travel across Ontario to do research for the Alternative Dispute Resolution Manual that we came up with. It was based on a Haudenosaunee framework, which is the great law. But looking around and trying to extract, what are your interventions to helping people going through trial welfare when they have crisis or when they're going to court? And we found that the Haudenosaunee culture and people are much more richer than a lot of cultures out there. Right, and it's because of the Ganeshagoa's great law, and so that's what I drew on, right? And I think that's the difference between what we offer and our program at the department. Lee wants to add into that piece.
I just wanted to speak about the presentation last night that Tom had put on. He touched a lot of that. I can't eloquently say everything that he said so well, but from what I took away from it, he just spoke about how we as Indigenous people have been colonized for so long, and it's been a really big part of how we haven't been able to actually look at justice through an Indigenous perspective, because we're constantly looking towards the people who've colonized us for the affirmation, for them to tell us and what we can and what we cannot do. He also spoke about how we had the ability to love one another, and we took care of one another, and it was really important for us that we didn't judge one another based on our characteristics. We didn't critically characterize anybody. We were more welcoming towards one another, and he really made sure that he spoke about how through each part of the great law there was restorative justice, even from the beginning when the baby came into the mother, mm-hmm. and the grandmother tried to get rid of the baby. It always hurts to even say that she tried to kill the baby, because it just feels so wrong, but they were able to repair that relationship. Mm-hmm. There were so many good things that he said last night, and it was just really eye-opening for me, even, because it gave me a whole new perspective on how to look at restorative justice, because it was just so deep into who we are as Haudenosaunee people, as Indigenous people, because I'm sure there's other parallel stories and other Indigenous communities that can transform or translate to that loving, unconditional loving And basically getting back to it as a community is being able to love one another and provide that support and to stop judging one another, because we've been doing that. That's been done long enough. I don't know, Tom, did I forget anything? Because there was a lot you did touch on last night, and I want to thank you, because it was really beautiful.
Thank you. No, I thought you did a good Reader's Digest. And I thought the crowd, the group that was there last night were really a fantastic group of people. And I was surprised so many elderly people were there and how tuned in they became to everything. I was kind of overwhelmed by their attentiveness. So there's a great need for all that to take place. It's just we have to find the environment and the atmosphere where it can be talked about in a comfortable way. I guess that's timing is everything in teaching and any program. Timing is just like when you pick apples. You can't pick green apples and expect it to taste good. You got to wait until it gets ripe and when it ready to fall, and then you make some pies. And the same thing with everything in this world. Everything has its time, so you have to find out when. Can we do this? When will the ears open to understand? Because everything's about communication. Everybody can become agreeable, because our great law and our ceremony law, everything we have, and the Haudenosaunee, they always says, Ska-ni-gung-la. That means one mind. We have to become one mind. Everything, what we do, grandmothers, chiefs, faith keepers, people, one mind we must become. In order to get one mind, it means that we have to sit down and we have to talk to each other. And I mean talk to each other, not scold each other or not belittle each other or not have a contest of who knows more. Just talk together. And until we can all agree on and become one mind, then we can go forward. It's as simple as that, really. So how do we get all of the hurts that we've had as a people, and get a comfortable place that we may discuss this freely, openly, and in a healthy way. And then we can start to do things to fix our community.
Mm-hmm. You know, Tom, I have to ask, and I mean, you like me, we have been on God's Green Earth for a while now, and we've seen a lot of things. Do you see that there is still a lot more room for improvement with regards to the way Aboriginal people are treated in the legal system here in Canada?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my I don't know, I might upset the apple cart a lot, but I'm going to say this, it doesn't matter because I'm over 39 years old now. So I'm not running no popularity contest. My understanding, or what I've come to understand, is that I say we need to indigenize the whole world. We have to indigenize the whole world. And in indigenous thought, there is restorative justice automatically in there. It's just that everybody did have restorative justice at one time at the beginning. But I tell people, because I just got back from Europe, you know. I was there for 7 weeks in Germany, mostly in Germany, Austria, Netherlands, and Italy. But I spent most of that 7 weeks in Germany. And I had the great honor and privilege of meeting with over 50 intentional German communities about the great law, about our spirituality, about the universal truths, and they were so open to it. They you know what they want to do? They want to reinstate strawberry ceremony over there. They haven't had a strawberry ceremony probably in 4,000 or 5,000 years, because the Europeans have been colonized way before the Mohawks or the Senecas or the Ojibwe. They've been colonized 4,000 or 5,000 years before. So they have to re-indigenize themselves, because the Lakota, the Haudenosaunee, all the Algonquin Nation peoples, indigenous people of the Western Hemisphere, we still have sun dancing. We still have moon ceremonies. We still have winter ceremony, maple tree ceremony, strawberry ceremony, raspberry ceremony, every kind of ceremony for all the natural world. We still have that going in all the longhouses. Lakotas have it, Hopis have it, but Europe doesn't. Europe has what they call, and this is what we discussed over there, fairy tales about little people. It's only fairy tales, like you see on Walt Disney show. It's become to them only fairy tales, but those used to be real. So I told them, over where we live in North America, we still have ceremonies for little people, and they heal people, and they open their eyes, open their ears up, and they listen, and they have come to the realization that because of their colonization, all of their spiritual has turned into fairy tales by the powers that be. And now, because of that, the imbalance has come to the German people and French people. They don't know how to balance their daily life. So they're looking for truth again. Yeah. And so my son and I met with them. And we even told them what we do with strawberries. And when we were there, strawberries were just being harvested. So we went and got strawberries, and we made strawberry drink over there. Mm-hmm. And I taught them all. And even we got some little girl, little boy from the German, each community, to take buckets of strawberry juice and go to each German person in that meeting. And they did just like we do at our longhouse. They each stood up and they gave thanks to the Creator and to the strawberry, first time in 4,000 years. And they were so happy. And they said, that's what we're missing after 4,000 years. So what I'm saying is I think that restorative justice is going to come to the world, not just to us. And we have to indigenize. And Native people can help in that process because our colonization is only 200 years old. So our indigenous knowledge is still in our DNA. It's just right under that first skin. Mm-hmm. So it's easily accessible. Whereas in Europe, their indigenous knowledge is way down, deep buried, because 4,000 years since they were colonized. So that's where they need help from the Iroquois, from the Lakota, from the Hopi, wherever, to share the original truths. Because in the original truths, that's where we have ceremonies for water, ceremony for thunder, ceremony for sun, ceremony for everything that constitutes what we need to live on a daily basis. And then that's where we will find balance and justice, not just to us, but justice to all living forces that give us life. So it's good, to me, very excited. But in order to do this, the indigenous population has to heal from all our hurts, from all the trauma of the history, which is very recent and still ongoing. In the court systems that we have to deal with, we're still being treated like we're not really a people. And to give you an example that I know, because I have had some dealings too with the court and over some of the rights that we have to fight for over the years. And most Indian people, even if they're assimilated, because of the DNA, it's just right below the first skin. When the judge says, you guilty or not guilty, any Indian person, if he appears in court, will say, yes, I did do that. Because in our culture, if you tell the truth, that's part of healing. That's part of what you're supposed to do. But in the Western court system, if you say guilty, you get penalized for telling the truth. That's a big difference. And that concept goes way back. That has to be eroded. That has to be sanded down. So that's not like that anymore. and smooth it out so that when you tell the truth, it's part of your medicine to get better, not punished. You don't get punished for it. So restorative justice is really an important topic. And I think for our people, it's really, really important because we're hurting so bad. We have an inferiority complex, so we have to deal with that because you can't do anything if you have that, if you carry that around. So we have to find ways to open the ears of our people and to let them know what the Creator gave us in terms of laws, great law or ceremonies and all that. It's a gift from the Creator. No place else. And that it's healthy and it's good for us to have. And that's our task, is how do we tell our people whose ears were colonized to be closed to those truths? How do we make the rabbit put his ears up again to become a rabbit? To a Mohawk and become a real Mohawk, and a Seneca, a real Seneca, and Ojibwe, a real Ojibwe. Because that's what the Creator wants us to do. So last night, that's what we tried to do. And and I didn't know what to do either, because the task is so huge and humongous. How do you take a people that's hurting in all ways, spiritually, physically, and disconnected as society? How do you do that?
One at a time.
Yes.
One at a time.
Yeah.
That's how we have to grow in the Justice Department. Yeah. It's one client at a time, and every client is different.
But food helped a lot.
I'm just wondering, Abby, from your perspective of being a Crown for 15 years, like your Al's question about, the restorative justice against the criminal legal system. What does that look like?
Okay, so in the criminal context, there's a section of the criminal code that I'm sure everybody's aware of, it, 718. And it mandates the courts that they have to look for alternatives to incarceration for Indigenous people because we are overrepresented in the jail systems. So in Brantford, which is what I'm familiar with, in 2014, they started, it started off as a Gladue court, and it became the Indigenous People's Court. And that is the criminal court's response to attempting to reduce the incarceration of Indigenous people. So what that may look like, for example, is if we have cases that come in that we think should be diverted, we will refer to the Six Nation Restorative Justice Program for them to deal with it in whatever way they see fit. They will advise the criminal court once that diversion has completed, and once that diversion is completed, we withdraw those charges against a person. So that's one of the responses. I think it's really underutilized currently, and I'm hoping to see that be more utilized in the future. That usually is sort of not the more serious cases. They're the lower end cases. The Indigenous People's Court sits on Wednesdays in Brantford, and an Indigenous person has the option. They don't automatically go to Indigenous People's Court, but they have the option to go into that court or to stay in the mainstream court. If they choose to go into the Indigenous Person's Court, that is premised on that they are going to accept responsibility, acknowledge what they have done, and from there, then if they choose, they will have what's known as a sentencing conference, where everybody, the offender, any support people, family, the judge, the Crown, the defense lawyer, any other people that are assisting, will sit in a conference, and the purpose of that conference is to learn the background of the offender, what brought them there, and what can we do moving forward, what help they need. We're there to learn their story and what would assist. So out of that conference, a plan will be developed moving forward as to what things that they can do that may assist them to keep them out of the criminal court system. It's a lengthy process. Sometimes they will order what's known as a Gladue report. Those are prepared by Aboriginal Legal Services. Again, that is assists the court in fashioning some sort of sentence. It gives the court the background, all the Gladue factors. It talks about residential school, colonization, the particular background, family background of the offender. And that information is not shared by everybody in a conference, but the judge reads it, the Crown would read it, and the person that has been charged, they would have read it as well. So all of that informs fashioning a sentence that either reduces the incarceration or does not involve incarceration at all. So that process, the Indigenous Peoples Court, has been evolving since 2014. It still has a way to go. Currently, as it stands, and I think that's in a change of flux right now, is that victims that have not been part of that process in the future will be part of that process. So it will be more holistic and include everybody. So that right now is the response. Is it a complete response? No. Has it got a lot of it needs more work, but as I said, it's in a state of it's evolving. And I'm sure what is currently existing in a couple of years will look quite different from what it looks like today, just as it looks different from when it started in 2014. So
I hope so, because I've observed the IPC court, and I feel, and I've actually presented to the court to say you're not, it should be restorative in the sense that there's both the victim and the offender. I think they take offense to what I have said, but I think when I'm observing it, it's just they're paying attention to the offender with the sentence in circle, right? And I think that person is still not accountable to the people or the person that he's harmed, and that person should be included. And I said this is not fully restorative. You're helping this individual. I plead guilty to this, but he's still accountable only to the court and not to the persons or to the community that he comes from.
That's correct.
A big difference between what our programs, Lee and Lady, are doing, is trying to get the offender and the victim in there to talk that out, to work out an agreement. Like, how are those reparations going to be made? So, Lady, if you want to speak about who qualifies for our program.
So now we are working with individuals from 12 years and up. So we only take minor offenses so far, such as theft, under maybe some cases of assault, mischief. So we also take pre-charge and post-charge, meaning that the pre-charges are people that are diverted by the police, so they are not in contact with the court system. And the post-charge is when people are already involved with the court system. So that's the individual we're working with right now. We only work with indigenous peoples, and we serve the victim and the offender.
And the other thing I want to ask, Abby, is what are the driving principles of the IPC court, if you know that, or the philosophy of the court, other than the criminal code?
Well, it's based on the criminal code. It's the criminal court's response, so it is a government court that is working or dealing with Indigenous people. So their driving philosophy, I'll go back to the Section 718, it's to reduce the incarceration or take away the incarceration if possible. Mm-hmm. It's a punitive system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can add something to, when we talk about Section 717 of the criminal code.
717,
which gives the Crown discretion to decide how to proceed with the cases that come to them.
Right.
So that's how they decide the person is going to be approved for diversion. So I see that this is not working either, because we see people still being criminalized for being addicted to drugs, for having mental health issues. So that's still, I don't know. I'm just trying to put my thoughts together here. So but we still see those inconsistencies when it comes to the sentence. So I don't know if you can speak a little bit about that too, because that has been a concern for us too. This is getting more people in trouble for simple offenses. So seeing this is consistency, we see that the way some of the crimes are proceeding are very unjust.
So pre-charge, the police have the option to pre-charge, and they will do that for low-end offenses. So we don't even, as a Crown attorney, you wouldn't see those offenses. They wouldn't even come into the Crown's office. They would be diverted before they even get to the Crown's office. When a charge comes to the Crown's office, somebody looks at it and screens it. Depending, there's a number of Crowns. Everybody's an individual, so some Crown may see something more serious than another Crown will. So it's a discretionary thing, and it depends on each Crown. But within the Crown policy, there is, for diversion, things that are on theft under $5,000, anything under $5,000, so smaller offenses, property offenses, cause disturbance, those types of things. Mm-hmm. Even if it is not screened for diversion, certainly somebody could advocate to the Crown's office for diversion and give the background. A Crown that's necessarily not necessarily knowing may not know that that person is Indigenous. You can't always tell just by looking at a name. Mm-hmm. So there's information that a Crown wouldn't have that can always be brought forward to a Crown, and then they can reconsider their position hopefully divert it.
Thank you. No, we talked about it before. I was just asking Abby because I wanted to share with the community so they can have a better understanding of how the process is going at court. But thank you.
How does one advocate that information? Like if I were a community member listening to this, right, and I knew I had been in trouble, and you're talking about, you know, you can bring that information to the court.
Right.
You can advocate. How would I know how to do that? What would I have to do that?
Well, so somebody gets charged, and when they start making appearances in court, they're given what is known as a screening form. A screening form will set out how the Crown is proceeding and what sort of penalty that they are looking for. They also can screen it for diversion, and that screening form will indicate that. So that's the person looks at the screening form, and from that they learn what the Crown is looking for. If it's a low-end offense or something that can be diverted, that person, they can set up an appointment with the Crown's office. Usually they're assisted by duty counsel. They don't meet with the Crown directly, but they will be assisted that day, and they share the information with the duty counsel, or they can bring a support person with them. They can have letters from anybody that they choose that will help them. And when the duty counsel will meet with the Crown attorney and bring all that information to the Crown attorney. And the Crown attorney always has to look at the new information and always consider it. And that may change their position.
Thank you, Abby.
You're welcome.
If you're just joining us, ladies and gentlemen, this is a program about restorative justice here at CKRZ. Our panel includes Barbara General, Tom Porter, also Abby Avery, Lee Hill, and Lance Logan Key. And we'll be back with more on restorative justice right after a brief timeout.
Here's a fun fact about restorative justice. Do you know what restorative justice is? Restorative justice is a voluntary alternative process to the court system in which all those affected by crime have an opportunity to participate in the resolution of it.